The Phoenix City Council will be voting next week on a new budget. Supporters say it's balanced. But that view is not universally shared.
Their primary criticism is that the city is essentially kicking the can by claiming it has a balanced budget, but not paying its full pension costs today.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, GOP presidential candidates have been showing up across the valley. Visitors will soon be peering into the history of film pioneers of the Grand Canyon.
Has the digital world changed our perception of the First Amendment?
How we see ourselves in icons, and a new exhibit asks a question.
What would it be like if Superman was a Cherokee?
Plus, Scottsdale loses another piece of its Old West history, and we play the quiz.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. Look for cloudy skies across the valley for the rest of the afternoon. Pretty good chance you'll see some rain before it's all said and done with a high of 74 degrees. 90% chance of rain tonight, chance of thunderstorms as well, and overnight lows in the upper 50s. Partly to mostly cloudy tomorrow, slight chance of some more rain and a high of 78 degrees. Right now, cloudy and 71.
The WNBA is suspending two of the league's players after they were arrested for a domestic violence incident last month. KJZZ's Will Stone reports one of the women is Brittany Griner, a star for the Phoenix Mercury.
The WNBA has handed down the longest suspension in the league's history. Phoenix's Brittany Griner and Glory Johnson, who plays for the Tulsa Shock, will each miss 7 games, almost a fifth of the regular season, because of a physical altercation between the two of them at their home in Goodyear. Griner was arrested on suspicion of assault and later pled guilty to misdemeanor disorderly conduct. Johnson's case is still pending. The two All-Stars, who were recently married in Phoenix, will both receive counseling. The season starts up the first week of June. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
An additional clinic has been added to the Northern Arizona Veterans Hospital in Prescott. The new addition will focus on mental health and substance abuse treatment. It opens as the VA looks to provide treatment for the rising number of patients the hospital is seeing. Mary Dillinger with the hospital says the outpatient clinic will help accommodate the 180 patients who visit the Prescott Hospital every month.
We needed to find a way so that patients who maybe have substance abuse issues but don't necessarily need to stay in the program at the domiciliary can still get the care and treatment that they need. So now we are able to provide that.
Dillinger says the hospital saw 5,500 mental health patients in 2014, up 10% from the previous year.
Next Tuesday, the Phoenix City Council will vote on a final budget for the 2015-2016 fiscal year. Members of the city staff say that budget is in fact balanced. Critics aren't so sure. We asked Mario Paniagua, Phoenix Budget and Research Director, for the details.
It is quite an accomplishment, I believe, because a year ago, about this time, we were in our five-year forecast looking forward, projecting that there would be a significant deficit for 15-16. And that deficit, you know, had a range of between $14 and $54 million because it was such a long period of time. You know, we weren't sure exactly where that was going to be at that time. So the city council and the mayor took some early actions to avert the city having a deficit. And because of that, that leadership and hard work by city staff, we were able to get ahead of that and have a balanced budget. For example, you know, as the city negotiated labor contracts a year ago, that would cover fiscal years 2014-15 and 2015-16. There were actually some compensation concessions reducing overall compensation costs built in to those contracts in both years. And so, you know, that reduced costs for both 14-15 and 15-16.
So did an improving economy then have nothing to do with the improved budget situation?
You know, in this case, the projections that we had for revenue, which is where the economy comes into play, with the sales tax dollars being the biggest portion of the city's general fund, the projections were really not too far off. So the economic growth certainly was a factor, and the economic improvements that we've been seeing certainly were a factor, but a lot of that had been built into those projections at that time. So if it wasn't for the work we did on the expenditure side, even with that economic growth, we would have had a deficit. So the expenditure reductions really were the answer.
How can you respond to someone who might say, well, I don't believe it's balanced?
It really comes down to simple math when it comes to when we're looking at 2015-16. The challenge is, as we look ahead to future years, we know that we have challenges. And so we actually are projecting the possibility of a deficit, a shortfall in 2016-17. So again, we have to work with the mayor and council to get ahead of that and start addressing that.
Mario Paniagua, Phoenix Budget and Research Director. Dustin Gardner covers Phoenix City Hall for the Arizona Republic. He's talked to people, including council members, who have concerns about the proposed budget.
It's kind of become a semantic debate on some level. You know, technically, the budget is balanced on paper. The city's budget book projects, you know, that it'll have enough revenues to cover expenses next year. But in that, it's only balanced if you don't include the fact that the city is putting off paying its full pension obligations to the state. I think a pretty good way to put it is that the city, it's like the city has a mortgage and it can't afford its mortgage payment today. So it's taking out a bigger loan in order to, I guess, put off some of its increasing costs, hoping that it'll have more money to cover everything in a couple of years.
Could that affect at all how the council votes next week?
You know, based on everything we've heard to this point, I think there is a pretty solid majority on the council that will support this budget. I mean, just politically speaking, it's not hard to imagine why a city council member would prefer a budget that doesn't require the city to make immediate cuts to public programs or to scale back, you know, police hiring potentially. There are some opponents, I think. Their primary criticism is that the city is essentially kicking the can by claiming it has a balanced budget but not paying its full pension costs today.
What sort of money are we talking about here that the city may be holding off on paying at this point?
So the city's payments to the state pension system for police officers and firefighters are going up about $40 million a year, and that's a pretty dramatic increase, and the city isn't really prepared to pay for that today. And so they've opted to phase in the increase over 3 years, so that payment to the state system is only going up by about $6 million next year as opposed to $40 million. But at the end of year three, the city is going to be having to pay that full amount, and they're actually going to be paying more in the long run because they're increasing their long-term pension debt in order to not pay the full amount today.
Are there expectations for some sort of magic to happen, that the economy is going to somehow kick into high gear, which will bring in more tax revenue?
Well, the reality is they don't know how they're going to cover it yet. If they paid what they owe today, they would have roughly a $30 million budget deficit in the next fiscal year, which starts July 1st. You know, they're hopeful that they'll be able to save money or bring in revenues in a couple of areas that will help cover the gaps, but the details just really aren't clear at this point. I think one big thing that people are really holding out for is the hope that state lawmakers will make some sort of dramatic changes that reduce long-term pension expenses, because the pension system for police officers and firefighters is run by the state. The city really doesn't have a lot of control at all over how that system is managed, and it really comes down to the state making changes. And at least recently, state lawmakers haven't shown a lot of interest in making those kinds of changes.
Dustin Gardner covers Phoenix City Hall for the Arizona Republic. Even with our cooler temperatures around the valley lately, you may have also noticed an extra bit of hot air. Maybe that's because we've had visits from projected Republican presidential candidates Jeb Bush, Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, and Carly Fiorina. Arizona isn't one of the early primary or caucus states, so what are the candidates doing here? We talked with Republican Scott Smith, former mayor of Mesa.
They view Arizona as sort of the ultimate focus group, let's say. It's a very conservative state that actually can trend purple, as we've seen with our congressional and our swing districts in the congressional side. And yet you have obviously a very active and vocal and engaged Tea Party and conservative base, both of those. And I think they come to Arizona because they see it as a pivotal state. They see Arizona as being in the national spotlight for good, bad, whatever. And also, I think it's a place where they come because they feel they can test their message and see how it plays.
We know that Rand Paul was invited by the Maricopa County Republicans. We know that Marco Rubio was there with the Chamber of Commerce. Governor Ducey was there. Does that tell you anything in terms of who the invitations are coming from or who the candidates are trying to attract when they come for these little meetings?
I'm not sure it tells you a whole lot. There's no doubt that I don't think you're going to see the Red Mountain Tea Party in Mesa invite Jeb Bush to come speak to him. But then again, they have their own dilemma because are they a Ted Cruz? Are they Marco Rubio? Are they Rand Paul? I mean, once you get beyond some of the obvious ones, and there aren't that many obvious other than Jeb, then there's a whole long line. And I think if you walked into some of these groups, you'll find people who are passionate about Ted Cruz. They're passionate about Rand Paul. They're passionate about Marco Rubio, Scott Walker. And if you ask them to decide right now, they would say, gee, it's a toss-up for me.
How about money? Money is such an important thing. And I mean money in terms of, okay, we know when it comes to the big stage, they're going to need millions. Who knows, tens of millions. In Arizona, is there big money available to these candidates? Are they pitching themselves to big donors here?
Arizona's never been a really big money state. There are pockets of big money that can flow into to certain candidates. I don't think that any of the top-tier candidates are going to lack for money to get their message across. One of the unknowns in this Republican race is where will the real big money, the Koch money, let's say. Mm. Where are the Koch brothers and their affiliated groups? Where are they going to land?
The term kingmaker, way too strong. But do you see any elected officials in Arizona being the type that these Republican candidates really want to get, if not an endorsement from, real support from?
There's no one person that really sticks out. John McCain has his own issues and is going to be worried about his campaign. And then you look at the state level and all those elected officials, they're all so new. And I don't know what their base is. I'm not sure that there's any one elected official that is a difference maker here in Arizona. I think the thing that's going to make the difference is, once again, is there money going to be spent and who spends it?
Do you see Arizona playing a big role considering how many people are running based on what you said about who the candidates are?
It can. Will it? It's all going to depend on how many people are in the race when we get through New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada, the really early ones. Last time, if you remember, the reason why the Mesa debate was so pivotal is that it was almost the tipping point. Mitt Romney had won a couple of big ones, had lost a couple of big ones. And ours was the only debate in February before the big first, the first of how many Super Tuesdays we had. Mm-hmm. And so that debate took a special place in the campaign. And Mitt Romney started on a roll right after that debate that then made him inevitable within the month.
Former Mesa Mayor Scott Smith, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Shortly after the shooting earlier this month at an event featuring cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in Garland, Texas, authorities determined the two suspects had attended a mosque in Phoenix. After that, the Islamic Community Center of Phoenix received nasty emails and saw a drop in attendance at Friday services. The center also increased its security. For more on the response to this incident, we turn to Salam al-Mariati, president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Unfortunately, that is an expected reaction to a number of incidents that make the news, especially involving violence in the Middle East or individuals who engage in criminal activity and violence. And in the name of our community, I think it's understandable, it's just unfortunate that you have this kind of backlash that our community has to endure all the time, especially when, in the case of Garland, Texas, especially the imam and the community there basically took a stand to demonstrate self-restraint, not to be incited to violence, and yet two individuals who happen to be associated, or at least one, with the Phoenix Muslim community did. And unfortunately, the rest of our community has to bear the brunt and burden of those criminal acts.
How does a congregation go about trying to separate itself and what it is all about and what it teaches from the people who are doing these things?
Well, I think this points to a larger problem in the American public, and that is that Muslims are still relatively unknown to the American public, to the average American. Muslims, especially American Muslims, are still known for what they are not as opposed to who they are. In other words, they are not the people who went to, in Garland, Texas, and tried to attack a group of cartoonists. They are not the groups that do videos like ISIS. But when all we have is to explain what we are not, that's all people think about. In other words, if I tell you don't think of an elephant, then you think of an elephant. When Richard Nixon says, I am not a crook, everybody thought he's a crook. And so if all the image of Muslims point to what we are not, then that's all people think about, that we are not radicals, we're not extremists, yet they don't know who we are, at least in the public arena.
Does the backlash that mosques and Islamic cultural centers have faced after an incident with one of their congregants, does that dissipate or does that sort of become the new normal for them?
Unfortunately, this is the new normal, and it's been the new normal since 9/11. It's the post-9/11 era. It's living under a cloud of suspicion. It's always having to argue that you're just as human as the other human being, and you're just as American as other Americans. And I think that's an unfortunate reality in American politics.
Salam al-Mariati is president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Salam, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Coming up, is virtual flag desecration as impactful as burning the real thing?
In the virtual world, you could set a virtual flag on fire with a virtual fire, and that really nothing was consumed, nothing was destroyed.
That story's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's the show on KJZZ. In traffic, big news, a crash is closing the 51 northbound at Cactus. You should try the 101 or I-17 as alternate routes. There's already a heavy backup. Again, avoid that area, 51 northbound at Cactus. Cloudy skies tonight around the valley, a 90% chance for rain. Look for overnight lows to be in the upper 50s. Should be partly to mostly cloudy tomorrow with a high of 78 degrees. It's currently cloudy and 74 at 220.
KJZZ is supported by University of Arizona Eller MBA, with two programs for working professionals in downtown Phoenix and a 100% online option. Details about the Thursday, May 21st info session at ellermba.com.
In the early 1900s, two brothers, Emery and Ellsworth Kolb, saw an economic opportunity at the Grand Canyon. But it didn't come without constant determination, much like the Kolb Studio itself, which has clung to the side of the Grand Canyon for more than a century. Advocates of this historic gem are in the midst of restoring the home and studio so it stays for at least 100 more years. KJZZ's Laurel Morales takes us there.
Emery and Ellsworth Kolb embodied the pioneering spirit. In 1905, they struck a deal with entrepreneur Ralph Cameron. The Kolbs would take tolls from visitors. In exchange, they could build a studio on Cameron's mine claim. At first, they lived in a tent, took pictures of tourists, and developed them in a mine shaft to sell them. But as the Grand Canyon Association's Phil Payne tells it, Emery fell in love with a young woman named Blanche Bender.
And she said, well, I'd love to marry you, but I'm not going to live in a tent with your brother. You got to build me a house. And so exactly. So she was the real reason why we got this place started.
And as their business grew, they added on. The building is now over 5 stories tall and has over 26 rooms cascading down into the canyon. It's bolted to the canyon wall with a narrow ridge underneath it. It was designed to flex because it sits over Arizona's largest fault line. Today, tourists can take a detour off the South Rim Trail and into the Kolb Studio gift shop and gallery. Payne hastily punches in a code, opens a secret door, and we step back into time. Most park visitors don't get to see this.
And look at that view.
Yeah.
is this the room
this
you were
was
talking
about? This was the sunroom, yep. So this was Emery's favorite room of the house. And from here, you can see the trees down there are Indian Garden, where they'd have to go for their water. And so it's only about a 4-mile trip, over 1,000 feet in elevation change. So.
Only 4 miles.
Yeah. No. There's a reason why you live to be 95.
Right. So.
Every day, the Kolbs would take pictures of the tourists traveling down into the canyon on mules. Emery would run down to the springs at Indian Garden to develop the film and have them finished to sell by the time the visitors journeyed out of the canyon. In addition to photographing visitors, the brothers made films of their adventures. They were the first to film a boating expedition from the Green River in Wyoming all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Eventually, they added an auditorium to their studio where they could show their films. Emery would stand on the balcony and narrate, as you hear in this film.
Our purpose was to attempt to make the first pictorial record in motion pictures of this country and river, which we did in moving picture infancy before Hollywood was much heard on.
The Park Service did not always welcome the Kolbs at the canyon. Payne says Emery and Ellsworth used the films to their advantage, showing them to politicians who helped the men secure their place at the park.
He was definitely a rebel. He would do whatever it took to get the job done. And that if that meant stepping on some toes, he would do that.
Today, Grand Canyon Superintendent Dave Ubaraga says the studio is considered a crown jewel at the park.
There isn't anything like it anywhere, and so you look at how they were adventurous and say, okay, well, we need to add this. We've grown. It has that entrepreneurial feel. These buildings, the story, the human story to me, makes the building, and then the building in and of itself has its own story, but without the two, they're not as strong.
After Emery Kolb died in 1976, the studio was abandoned. Pipes burst, vandals broke windows, and animals took up residence. In the early 90s, the park's nonprofit partner, the Grand Canyon Association, stepped in to restore it. The group has worked with a historic architect to renovate the building as accurately as possible, down to the type of paint and shingles they use. The renovations took 2 years, and now the public can see what it looks like. I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
The newly renovated Kolb Studio will be rededicated tomorrow. The renovation cost about $500,000. Miriam Robbins is director of marketing for the Grand Canyon Association, which raised most of the money for the project.
The Kolb Studio is a 100-year-old building, over 100 years old. And we work with the Park Service to help ensure that it maintains its historic integrity. So as you can imagine with any old building or structure like that, there's certainly a lot of unforeseen things that can happen. We in the National Park Service worked with a group called the Western Historical Preservation Society, who really helped guide some of the historic elements of the building, making sure that, you know, down to the proper type of paint that was used, making sure we had the proper windows and woods and different materials put in. So relatively smoothly, given all of that, but I think as with even a modern construction project, you know, things can be delayed and timelines can be pushed out.
Was there something in particular, maybe a couple of things that came up that were just totally unexpected, that you sort of had to change your plans to try to take into account in this really, really old building?
You know, I don't think that there was anything completely unexpected. I think that, well, for instance, I think there's a lot of unknowns. One thing that was a little bit unknown until it got started was the building is about 6 stories high on the edge of the Grand Canyon. So imagine how to actually paint that side of the canyon. There was a lot of discussion about using a crane to lower people over the side of the building and have them sort of hanging off the crane to be able to do some painting. What ended up happening, though, was the crew was able to put up about 6 stories of scaffolding. The entire building was surrounded by scaffolding 360 degrees to do the painting. And I did not want to be one of those people sitting on the 6th story of the scaffolding on the edge of the canyon. But everything was safe and everything was done properly. It was just there's some challenges that we didn't figure out until they actually started happening.
What will this building be used for now?
Currently, it's a retail store for the Grand Canyon Association. There's also a gallery that we have currently an exhibit of the Kolb brothers called The Amazing Kolb Brothers. So if you go up the canyon, you can learn about their history and their photography studio that was housed in that building. We also hold other special events there during different times of the year.
What do you think that having this studio now rehabbed and open to the public will do sort of for the Grand Canyon National Park overall?
Oh, I just think it's amazing. The canyon itself is a wonderful geological wonder. The history of the pioneers that came and settled there even before it was a national park is very fascinating and really shows a lot of our American history and migration to the West and how people started to really appreciate and understand Grand Canyon and bring it to the place that it is today.
Miriam Robbins is Director of Marketing with the Grand Canyon Association. Miriam, thank you.
Thank you.
Burning the American flag is typically a way to upset people, but it's also protected by the First Amendment. Last month, a college student in Georgia challenged young people to post videos of themselves defacing the American flag. Then an Eastern Arizona man responded by posting a video on Facebook calling for people to get a flag and display it proudly. What should we make of this kind of virtual back and forth? We turn to Gene Polasinski, COO of the Newseum Institute and Senior Vice President of the First Amendment Center.
The flag is ultimately a symbol, and whether it's virtual or real, it's a symbol. And the courts began in the early 1900s to try to protect the commercial use of the flag. Really, starting in the 1930s, they began to say that the symbolic act of desecrating and burning an American flag was sort of the ultimate free speech in this country, and they've protected it really ever since, up until a really important decision, two of them in 1989 and 1990, where they really said, if it's political speech, it's protected, and even if it's offensive to a great many Americans, which I'm sure it is, it's protected speech, and whether it's virtual or real, that's protected.
Considering it is virtual, and as you say, the flag is a symbol, but is there a more visceral reaction to things when people actually see a real flag being burned, stomped on, for example, as opposed to seeing it on a computer screen?
Well, I think we're accustomed to seeing great many fictional things on screens, televisions, computers, now increasingly on your mobile device, and I don't think it has the visceral reaction of seeing something live, but that's true for a great many things that we see on the screen versus right in front of us. There's still a case to be made that a virtual flag is, even if it portrays an American flag, is not an American flag. In fact, that was one of the classic exemptions to the objections to burning a physical flag, was that in the virtual world, you could set a virtual flag on fire with a virtual fire, and that really nothing was consumed, nothing was destroyed. So, again, that, even more than the real flag and desecrating that, I think it's more of a concept than an idea, because ultimately it's just a collection of electrons. Now, I have sort of my own corollary to all of the protections for free speech that I agree with in this, and that is it's a really lousy way to get somebody to stand behind your point, because every poll I've seen over 20 years says somewhere between 75% and 90% of Americans find flag burning repellent and any kind of desecration of the flag, and that would include virtual desecration. So I'm always puzzled when people do this as a matter of political speech, because it's probably the last way you're going to actually rally people around your cause.
It seems that political speech, though we all like to talk about logic, political speech often is pushed by emotion. And maybe when you're that emotional, you're thinking in terms of, I want to see if I can, even in the case of making people angry, at least they'll pay attention to me.
Well, I think that's exactly the way our founders decided and really got to the First Amendment, was if it's speech that doesn't upset, doesn't provoke, doesn't make you think, doesn't maybe make you mad, it doesn't need protection because people will just say it, no one cares.
Do you think the fact that more people are comfortable sitting in their living room or their computer room, do you think we may see more of this as people are sort of, those who are less comfortable actually being out front with a sign?
Well, it's an interesting idea that somehow being at home makes it easier to do something that you wouldn't do in public, and I suppose that's true. I think there's probably a sort of a natural limit. At first it's shocking, and then people will go, oh, it's that again, and it'll tail off, and it loses that shock value. You know, it's hard to predict the future, but the past is any kind of predictor. Flag burning just doesn't have a lot of traction in America, flag desecration, that is, and I don't know why that would necessarily change online, although there's an anonymity factor that makes it a little easier if you're so inclined to do it.
Gene Polasinski is Chief Operating Officer of the Newseum Institute. He's also Senior Vice President of the First Amendment Center. Gene, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
Still to come, Phoenix has adopted a new icon to represent disability accessibility. Could more symbols be changing as well?
That says to me that maybe there's a possibility to have like multiple symbols that are close enough that they would speak to kind of a diversity.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Well, on this cloudy Friday, a couple of major trouble spots in Valley traffic to tell you about. The biggest one is the 51 northbound. That is now closed at Cactus because of a collision. There's a heavy backup for several miles. Just avoid the area if you can. 51 northbound closed at Cactus. Also, the 202 westbound, a collision at 24th Street. Looks like it might be causing a backup on I-10 westbound as well. We have a 90% chance for rain tonight around the valley. Look for lows to be in the mid to upper 50s. It's currently cloudy and 74 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, where the healing power of nature is combined with modern medical science. Now accepting applications for fall admission at scnm.edu.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. A Boston jury says Zhohar Tsarnaev should be put to death by lethal injection for his role in the Boston Marathon bombings. Jack Lepiarz with member station WBUR in Boston was inside the courthouse when the verdict was read. He says jurors obviously did not buy into the defense argument that Tsarnaev was following his brother's lead, was sorry for his crimes, and therefore should receive life in prison for the attacks that killed four people and wounded more than 260.
The issue of remorse was presented as a mitigating factor by the defense, and only two jurors said that Zhohar Tsarnaev appeared to communicate remorse. Most jurors did not think that he wouldn't be able to incite or commit future crimes of violence, even if he went to life in prison. On the subject of Tamerlan Tsarnaev being the lead actor in the affair, so to speak, only three jurors thought that Tamerlan Tsarnaev was the reason Zhohar Tsarnaev committed the crimes. Tamerlan Tsarnaev was the one who influenced him to commit the Boston Marathon bombings.
As the verdict was read, Tsarnaev had his head down slightly and his hands folded in front of him. Authorities have found the wreckage of the U.S. Marine helicopter that disappeared in Nepal while on a relief mission, and they do not believe there are any survivors. There were six Marines, two Nepalese Army soldiers on board. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says it could take a while to recover the victims.
The wreckage is an exceptionally remote location, and so it will be a long and difficult process to recover the wreckage, as well as any remains.
Warren says they have visually identified what appear to be two sets of remains. The recovery mission will resume at first light tomorrow. On Wall Street, for a second day, the S&P posted a new high, up 1 point. The Dow gained 20 points, finishing at 18,272. The Nasdaq lost 2. This is NPR.
A few years back, the Heard Museum had an exhibit up which featured a ceramic vase. On that vase, the artist had painted a picture of the Incredible Hulk and his father as a boy reading a comic book. That got Ann Marshall, Director of Curation and Education at the Heard, thinking about superheroes and their place in American Indian culture. The result is a new exhibit opening tomorrow at the museum called Superheroes, Art, Action, Adventure.
That was my first clue about where some American Indian artists were going with making the whole idea of superheroes that had been a part of their lives and a part of their parents' lives into something that was a little closer, that brought people into their culture, and just imagining what would it be like if Superman was a Cherokee.
It's interesting because when you look at sort of the traditional superheroes, not a lot of diversity among those people.
I know. And the diversity is here as American Indians are creating superheroes.
So do you find that the artists are imagining superheroes as American Indians, or are they sort of interpreting what those superheroes meant to them?
You know, it's a combination. Some people have done representations of mainstream superheroes that, as I said, what if they were Cherokee? There's some of that. Then there's some creation of superheroes who are entirely Native American and who are, in some instances, coming out of very old traditions, oral stories, our histories, and in some cases, history that is real.
So artists are taking actual historical figures and sort of turning them into superheroes, it sounds like.
Yes.
So is part of the goal of this exhibit to let folks know about these American Indian superheroes? And it's not just Batman and Spider-Man and Superman, but there are these other superheroes
Absolutely.
Out there.
Absolutely. We really want to shine a light on the artists who are making stories that are just fun, in some instances scary. They're doing great art. And it's something that the family can enjoy and would love to see some discussion across generations between adults and kids about what makes a superhero and maybe about how they find the superhero in themselves.
What was the relationship, if there was one, between some of the more, and again, I'll call them traditional superheroes, people like Spider-Man and Batman and Captain America? Was there interaction between those superheroes and American Indian communities, sort of in the stories that were told about them?
You know, I think that the interaction has been in the hearts and minds of the artists. These were people who, as kids, or maybe their parents, grew up reading about Batman and Spider-Man and thinking, you know, well, how would Batman solve this problem? And so I think that's what's coming forward. But taking the next step then and thinking, oh, what if this superhero really was from my community?
Does that sort of give folks maybe a greater sense of identity or confidence or something like that, if they can picture a superhero as one of them?
I think so, and I think it comes, too, from people who are justly proud of their heritage and who stop and say, wait a minute, we've got superheroes, and as an artist, I want to talk about them, I want to draw them, and I want to depict them.
Ann Marshall is Director of Curation and Education at the Heard Museum. The exhibit opens tomorrow afternoon and will be up through August 23rd. And Steve, if you go, don't worry if you forget your cape at home. They've got a bunch you can borrow while you're there. This week, Phoenix unveiled a new icon for disability accessibility. It depicts someone wheeling a wheelchair and will replace the old icon, which showed someone just sitting in a wheelchair. This is part of the Accessible Icon Project, which is working to make the icon more active, and it's not the only conversation of its kind happening. For more on what people are talking about, we turn to Bess Williamson, who teaches the history of design at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago.
These symbols were originally designed starting around in the 1930s and 1940s and then going forward in a few different time periods by people who really wanted to, who wanted to develop a kind of language of symbols that would be universal, that would be like understandable by everyone. But it seems like one of the problems we're having is that people look at those symbols and don't identify themselves with them. Like they don't look familiar. They seem to be too restrictive in terms of the, you know, strong binary male or female. So it's interesting how these things seem to bring up as many questions as they do kind of resolve the issues. So it seems like there's a lot of conversation going on about them that maybe those really stock, you know, having just a one symbol that represents a group of people seems to be maybe more of a problem than it was in the past.
Have you seen that these symbols have evolved over time since they were first started to be introduced, you know, in the earlier part of the last century?
Yes, they certainly have. These symbol systems are usually traced back to a certain symbol group that was developed by two designers in Austria called isotypes. But then there are these newer updates, right, that suggest maybe that we actually do want more variety. So the biggest example of kind of an intervention is in that so-called handicap symbol, which was developed in the 1960s. Where there have been a couple of different efforts in the last couple of decades to make it look more active and more sort of sporty and mobile in a way. that says to me that maybe there's a possibility to have like multiple symbols that are close enough that they would speak to kind of a diversity. There's a newer graphic design project called the Noun Project, which kind of compiles all, like basically all known existing icons. So for all kinds of things, not just people, but like cameras and, you know, roadside assistant symbols, like that, all those kinds of symbols. And I thought that was kind of interesting that it seems to be suggesting that there could be like 10 different symbols that represented the bathroom or something rather than having just one.
But isn't the point of these symbols so that somebody can sort of quickly look at it and instantly know what it represents? I mean, if you have 10 different versions of an icon for cameras, doesn't that just sort of confuse things?
It definitely could, absolutely. But I think maybe the way we can look at it is that any symbol is bound to be confusing. I always think of this kind of funny, you know, sort of graffiti project that exists that's based on the symbol that's on hand dryers, you know, that has a hand underneath these waves that go down to the hands.
Oh, sure.
And there's like a jokey symbol that playing on that that's like, hand me the bacon, because it looks sort of like a strip of bacon falling into someone's hands. So I think there's some acknowledgement that these symbols are confusing anyway. And so that maybe suggests the possibility of trying alternative ones. But it is always a problem. No doubt there's the problem of just simply having something that identifies. That's the reason why we have this, you know, universally recognized wheelchair symbol, is that this is a legal requirement to properly mark accommodations. So we don't want to be so interpretive that it becomes confusing.
Bess Williamson teaches the history of design at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago.
A new clothing boutique that aims to serve transgender youth recently opened in downtown Phoenix. The show's Annika Klein was there for the I Have a Dream boutique's opening day.
Volunteers spent Martin Luther King Day transforming a church classroom into a small clothing store, complete with dressing rooms, mannequins, and a full-length mirror. Something you won't find here? Signs that say men and women over the clothing racks. It may not seem like a big deal, but it's huge for many transgender and gender nonconforming people. Ryan Mailer is a trans man and says for him, clothes shopping can be a negative experience.
It's not fun. I hate it.
Mailer says he knows what it feels like to go into the men's section of a department store and get weird looks. People assume he's in the wrong section. That's why he wanted to help start the I Have a Dream boutique.
Going into these places and being able to look at clothes and try on clothes without fear of being judged, being able to take away something that will make them feel good about themselves, it's really the little things that make us feel so much better.
But a safe space for shopping is just one part of the project. Pastor Jeffrey Durham is one of the boutique's founders. He estimates it will serve many homeless transgender youth, a demographic he's been working with for years. Durham says LGBTQ youth are disproportionately represented in the homeless youth population, often because home can become an unsafe place after a young person comes out to family members. Once this happens, it can be a struggle just to meet their basic needs.
I just noticed a lot of them didn't have shoes, or it was really cold and wet out, and they're wearing flip-flops, because that's all they can afford.
Which leads to another thing you won't see here, price tags. It's a take-what-you-need system at no cost. But volunteer Mikkel Burns says it's not designed to feel like a clothing bank.
I wanted to have very much that store atmosphere where these are not charity cases, these are customers, these are shoppers. It's going to be a very dignified experience for the shopper to come in.
You know, you just grabbed, that was my tie.
That was?
Yeah, that's so cool.
The turnout was low on opening day, but the volunteers hope the shop will become a regular destination for transgender youth and others in need. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
The Pinnacle Peak Patio Restaurant will be closing next month. It follows other Old West-style facilities that have either closed or moved from Scottsdale, including Rawhide and Greasewood Flat. So is the self-described West's most western town losing its westernness? To find out, we turn to Rachel Pearson, Vice President of Community and Government Affairs for the Scottsdale Convention and Visitors Bureau.
We're always sad to see a place like Pinnacle Peak close, but in Scottsdale, we still offer so many great attractions and restaurants and events that really showcase our Western culture.
Is it hard to consider it still the westmost western town when you have Rawhide has left, Riata Pass has closed, Greasewood Flat, and now Pinnacle Peak Patio?
You know, Mark, that's going to be a great question for the city, since that's their slogan and not a brand that the Bureau's ever used.
But presumably you use it in your marketing, right? I mean, you show desert scenes, you show scenes of Old Town Scottsdale, which, you know, is considered sort of an Old West kind of place, right?
Sure. Well, you know, what we've seen from even recent research that we've done is that the West, almost as you just indicated, can be very different for different visitors, depending upon their age and their demographics. So for some, the West really represents that traditional cowboy culture. And for others, the West can be that desert experience or can be represented by sort of the free spirit and maverick nature of a community.
Do you find that more and more of your marketing is sort of the luxury of Scottsdale and some of the resorts and being able to hike in the McDowell-Sinhorn Preserve, things like that, as opposed to some of the Old West type stuff?
Well, the way that we've marketed Scottsdale for years now is as an upscale resort destination. So we focus a lot on the resort and spa experience, our outstanding weather, golf, arts and culture, which does include both Western and Native American heritage. As you mentioned, outdoor adventure is really huge in Scottsdale, especially with the McDowell-Sinhorn Preserve. And we also accent the shopping, the dining, the nightlife, all of those great amenities that are happening here in Scottsdale.
So with some of the restaurants, the old, you know, the old-timey kind of restaurants that have closed, are you changing sort of how you're marketing the city's food scene?
Well, you know, we've really seen culinary experiences in particular gain a lot of popularity over the last few years. Travelers are seeking unique food and wine events and culinary tours. And what's great is that Scottsdale is getting some fantastic recognition for the talented chefs and the unique culinary concepts that we have here in Scottsdale. So, in fact, back in 2014, just last year, Scottsdale was named the number two foodie city in the U.S. by livability.com.
In your mind, do visitors still want the Wild West, the Old West kind of vacation?
There are definitely visitors who are looking for that traditional Western experience. International visitors in particular, those from Germany, have a desire for that cowboy experience here in Arizona. As I mentioned, we've got a variety of Western experiences that visitors can still enjoy. Of great note is the new Scottsdale Museum of the West that just opened, but we also have the Cowboy College, Rusty Spur Saloon, Handlebar J, lots of art galleries in downtown that focus on Western art. And then, of course, we've got dozens of equestrian events throughout the year.
Do you expect that some of those sort of traditional Old West places will continue to stay in business? I mean, do you expect more of them to be either closing or moving?
You know, we always see that the expectations and desires of our visitors change over time. So we absolutely, you know, cherish and try to preserve our history, but our community businesses have to evolve to those, you know, changing wants and needs of both residents and visitors.
Rachel Pearson is Vice President of Community and Government Affairs with the Scottsdale Convention and Visitors Bureau. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And now it's time for the quiz show. That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quizmaster who's won a Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing KJZZ reporter Carrie Young.
A couple of weeks ago, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two correct entries. The question was, find a number less than 100 that is increased by one-fifth of its value when its digits are reversed. The answer? 45.
Our randomly selected winners this week are Vidya Warrior and Whitney Woodworth. Leszek will play on behalf of Vidya, and Carrie will play on behalf of Whitney. Whoever wins will get a special KJZZ item.
All right, Leszek, the first question is for you. In Downers Grove, Illinois, McDonald's customers have the option to use a Create Your Taste kiosk to build their own dream burger. One man did that and wound up with a 3.8-pound hamburger, including 10 servings of bacon. But the maxed-out burger could have maxed out his credit card. How much did the burger cost? Was it A, $24.89, B, $22.35, or C, $19.74?
I'll go for A, $24.
You are correct. And the I should mention the burger looked very structurally unsound, too. It was it was stacked pretty high.
But I'm sure it was nutritionally satisfactory.
Absolutely. Full of calories. Okay, Carrie, the next question is for you. The streaming service Hulu just acquired the rights to what TV show valued at nearly $180 million? Is it A, Friends, B, Dawson's Creek, or C, Seinfeld?
Ooh, I am going to say Seinfeld.
You are correct. It's Seinfeld, and it makes it worth about $1 million an episode.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's impressive.
All right, Leszek, the new season of ABC's The Bachelorette starts on May 18th. Now, what you might not know is that Carrie and I are in a Bachelorette fantasy league, along with most of the KJZZ newsroom. But there's something dramatically different about this season. What is it? Is it A, The Bachelorette is actually a secret celebrity? Is it B, there are actually two Bachelorettes this season? Or is it C, The Bachelorette is only allowed to wear red dresses and the contestants are only allowed to wear black suits in support of heart disease awareness?
As you may know, I don't actually watch The Bachelorette.
This comes as a shock and surprise.
So this is going to be a complete and total guess. I will guess B.
The two Bachelorettes?
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. I think maybe you do secretly. I feel like you've gotten a lot of reality TV show questions right, and they somehow always come as a guess.
I just go for the lowest common denominator answer, and it usually works.
Yeah, usually that is the way to go. All right, Carrie. At the recent White House Correspondents' Dinner, sometimes known as Nerd Prom, what actor joined President Obama during his speech and acted as his, quote, anger translator? Was it A, Keegan-Michael Key, B, Aziz Ansari, or C, Kenan Thompson?
I will say A.
Did you watch the Nerd Prom?
I did.
Yeah, of course you did.
How can you be a reporter and not?
You are correct. Leszek, if you haven't already gotten your new Apple Watch, you may want to hold off because for some people, the watch has been malfunctioning. What characteristic tends to keep the watch from working properly? Is it A, people who have metal plates in their arms? B, people with wrist tattoos? Or C, people with engagement rings with diamonds that are over a carat?
I believe the Apple Watch has a a heart rate sensor on the underside, and I think a wrist tattoo would interfere with that, so I'll say the wrist tattoo.
You are totally right. I guess darker colored ink is a bigger problem. So, you know, Leszek, with your sleeves, you might want to just, you know, hold off.
Well, I'm holding off for the $17,000 Apple Watch.
Oh, is that the problem? It's not your wrist tattoos that are the problem?
No, it's not.
All right, Carrie, you've got to get this last question right to have a shot at winning.
All right.
And if you do, we'll go to a tiebreaker.
Ooh.
Carrie, the United States Geological Survey recently completed a large tracking study in the Everglades on what potentially invasive and also terrifying species? Is it A, the Burmese python, B, the Asian longhorned beetle, or C, the giant African snail?
I will say B.
It's actually A. It's the Burmese python. Yeah, turns out they take up a lot of space. Leszek, that means you are still the reigning champ.
Thank you, but Carrie pushed me to the wall on that one.
And we'll keep bringing Leszek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
Remember the big storms we had last fall? Those are examples of emergency situations where our local government works around the clock to ensure safety, but those problems are not handled in government office buildings. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez explains.
That 1950s public service announcement was aired about the same time this bunker was built. Located here is the Maricopa County Department of Emergency Management Center. It's a command facility located in the Papago Park Military Reservation in East Phoenix. Did you know the Emergency Management Center was built during the Cold War?
The building was initially put up in 1956, built by the Army Corps of Engineers.
Richard Langevin is a tech analyst for the center.
Originally built as a fallout shelter for county board of supervisors.
Langevin says this was built so that if any major emergency were to happen, county supervisors would come here and command and control the area safely. The building is nestled between two hills and constructed about 15 feet underground. As Landman opens the security door to make our way down the stairs, a burst of air shoots out. The concrete roof is a foot thick, with 2 feet of dirt on top of it. The walls and floor are also a foot thick. It's a small place. From here, county leaders could gather and manage response and recovery efforts.
We're here to take care of the citizens in unincorporated Maricopa County and support the cities if they need equipment or resources.
This room is filled with desks, computers, and telephones, and televisions on the walls. This is a modern version of the original room.
Well, we've actually had to go through and upgrade the electrical system several times and the lighting in here, and because there's only two outlets when it was initially built.
The bunker is also equipped with a decontamination area. Between the facility walls and the hill, there's a path, the decon quarters. It's like walking in a cave. People would walk through here toward washrooms, remove their clothes, step inside a shower, and get decontaminated.
It was hardcore Cold War. The Russians were going to attack, and we need to be able to plan for everything.
The bunker is equipped with generators and an air filtration system.
It was set up for contaminated air, an airburst, any type of fallout that was going on in the air, that it wouldn't actually get into the building. That's why when you come in the front door, you felt that blast of air come out. That's positive pressure. That's how much pressure I've got inside the building, pushing air out.
Among the items still in the building are radiation detectors and canned water. I shook it, but was not tempted to open and drink it. Langevin says someone here did and was told it tasted like water. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
When danger threatened him, he never got hurt.
If you've got ideas or know things that we should know, please tell us about them. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
And cover. He did what we all must learn to do. You and you and you and you.
Light rain has started to fall in the valley. We're currently at 74 degrees, and that big accident, 51 northbound at Cactus, which had blocked the freeway. Now a couple of right lanes have been opened.
If you're looking for something to do this weekend, you can check out REO Speedwagon Sunday night. That's a Talking Stick Resort in Scottsdale.
Phoenix Symphony Legends Series presents Super 80s, Super Diamond. That's tonight at 7:30 at Phoenix Symphony Hall.
Also, comedian Josh Blue will be performing his stand-up tonight and tomorrow at the Tempe Improv.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian and Anika Klein, Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs of the digital team. News director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. We're at the show at KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody for Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.